Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome, Mick Clifford, podcast of the Irish Examiner. Now, one of the more tragic figures of the revolutionary period in this country, and God knows that there were a lot of tragic figures from that time, but one who has always stayed in the public imagination is Roger Casement. He's the man who arrived in Bannistrand in North Kerry, fresh from Germany, on Good Friday 1916 and was quickly captured. By that stage, he'd already had a very full life and was considered one of the great humanitarians of his time for his exposure of the treatment of native people in colonial Africa and subsequently South America. Anyway, once he was captured and while the Rising's leaders were shot and quickly ascended to a form of martyrdom, Casement was taken to London, tried for treason and hung. And particularly because of his previous exploits, there was a campaign to save him. And then a series of diaries found their way into the public domain and they showed him to be what today we'd simply call a gay man. But back then, homosexuality was a crime of some disrepute and the diaries went into some detail of his liaisons. Down the years, there have been many accounts of Casement's life, but I would guess that few could match a recently published book. Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement by Roland Phillips. And Roland is a biographer of some repute in terms of his previous work. This book is detailed and analytical and it provides, I think, a fully rounded picture of this tragic figure. And it also deals head on with a particular issue that has resonated down through history in this country, and that's whether the diaries were forged, which was how so many of Casement's comrades from the time wanted to believe, and subsequent generations of Irish Republicans also wanted to believe. And that is dealt with as well pretty comprehensively, I think, in here. Roland Phillips joins me now. Roland, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on your podcast.
Roland, I suppose we'll start where Casement was coming into adulthood and he set off for Africa at a very young age. Briefly, would you just give us a brief account of his upbringing to that point and how he began to get on in the foreign service, so to speak?
Casement's upbringing was quite dysfunctional and I believe that his upbringing had the profoundest effect on many of his subsequent actions. His family were quite well-established, big farming family in Antrim. His father was a younger son, also called Roger, who had had a commission in the Indian Army, but he mysteriously sold it. And Roger Jr. was the youngest of four children. The mother, I suspect, was illegitimate. He could never find out anything about her forebears. And she had a grand Anglo-Irish name of Jeffson, but when he met Jeffsons in later life, none of them could place her. And she died. He was born in Sandy Cove in Dublin, but his childhood was spent rather peripatetically around. They lived for a time in Jersey. And then from the age of sort of five onwards, a peripatetic existence around boarding houses in outer London suburbs, Dorking, Leatherhead, Surrey towns. His mother died when he was nine of, I suspect, of alcoholism. Her death certificate says cirrhosis of the liver. And his father may well have been an alcoholic too. And when he was dying, when Roger was sort of 13, he went for the first time to live in Antrim with his uncle, who lived near Ballycastle, took him in. And that was his first sort of settled time between the ages of 13 and 15. And it's when he developed his great love of Irish history and he read the books in his uncle's library about the ancient kings of Ulster and so on. But he was a restless orphan. He went to live with his mother's sister in Liverpool, where his uncle worked for a shipping company that that did the shipping for the Congo. And from there, at the age of 18, he first went to the Congo on a ship as purser. He said he couldn't stand to live in Liverpool anymore, couldn't stand to be in England. He didn't want to work at a desk. And he had this sort of inbred restlessness.
Yeah, and as you say, a pretty itinerant sort of a childhood, one that these days people would read an awful lot into, but of course then we were living in a totally different era. He didn't set out in Africa to end up exposing all the wrong that was being done to the native people, but he found himself in a scenario whereby he decided he had to record all this.
Yes, he had an intense sympathy for the suffering of others or the suffering of animals or whatever it may be. And that may be to do with he was never able to connect because of his sexuality, never have a romantic relationship until late in his life when he had a disastrous relationship we'll come on to. And he poured his emotion into sympathy for the oppressed, and the people of the Congo were severely oppressed by the Belgian rubber collecting industry in particular. But to start with, you're right, he was doing a bit of trading. He was doing some surveying for the railways. He worked for a mission station for a time. So he did whatever jobs came his way. But what was always clear was he didn't want to live back in England or indeed Ireland. And when he became aware of the horrors, for example, any Congolese person, man, woman or child, who didn't collect enough rubber, the Belgian overseers would shoot them, and then to prove they'd shot them, cut their hand off and take their hands back to be counted. So, I mean, really terrible things going on. And Casement saw this as he went his way. He was nearly 20 years in the Congo in total. And when he became a consul, really, I believe, in order to expose these horrors, a consul in the British Foreign Office.
And it was in that capacity then he compiled a report, I think around 1903, and that was delivered to the British Foreign Office.
That's right. And the great thing about that report was, because he'd spent all this time there, he spoke many of the languages, and he went further up the Congo River than any other non-Belgian had been. And so he was really able to interview the tortured about their experiences, which made his report immensely powerful.
Yeah, and it was also, I suppose, a rare enough insight into the whole business of colonialism and the way that the European powers in general, the UK, France, Belgium and others, Italy, I suppose, the way that they were able to reap so much from the likes of Africa and Asia and the exploitation there and the cost that came at. So the report, while it was very powerful, it wasn't received everywhere with open arms, this kind of exposure of what was going on.
No, and particularly, not surprisingly, in Belgium, where they did everything they could to rebut it. And King Leopold of the Belgians had paid journalists writing for the Times in London, and he did everything he could to rebut it. But the impact of the report was very, very strong, particularly in America, where, of course, they had their own race relations issues, and indeed it was very much taken up by what was called the Negro Fellowship. And Mark Twain became a great champion of Casement's, and Conan Doyle in England became a great champion. So although it didn't immediately change anything, the international wheels moving as slowly as they did, which enraged Casement, it gave him a worldwide status. And I believe he was decades ahead of his time in his work in that way.
Oh, yes, and I think that's been accepted by people who've looked at this area, definitely, what he exposed in that regard. And you mentioned Mark Twain and Conan Doyle, but another man that he encountered, and this was out in Belgium, was Joseph Conrad, of course, the author of Heart of Darkness. And I just suppose for perhaps younger listeners, Conrad's Heart of Darkness was also the model for Apocalypse Now for Scorsese.
Absolutely.
But he was very impressed by Casement as well.
He was. So Conrad met Casement in 1890, when Conrad first went to the Congo as a steamboat captain. He hadn't published a word by that point, and he had his Polish name, which I won't try and pronounce. And he and Casement spent 3 weeks together. Of course, Conrad's second day he met Casement, and he recorded in his diary the things Casement has told me, the things he has seen, I could not. So he, Conrad, commented on the years of experience, and I think that that sort of mention of Casement and Casement telling his stories must mean Casement was a great influence on Heart of Darkness, which in fictional form exposed some of the horrors of the Belgian rule over the Congo.
Yeah, it does. It shows the reach of the man and the impact he had in an area that an awful lot of people didn't know about, and as I say, some of the powers that be didn't want to know about. Okay, and then he's back, and then later he sets off for South America.
Yes, he so made his name with his report that when word filtered back, there was a huge company, one of the biggest companies on the London Stock Exchange, called the Peruvian Amazon Rubber Company, which was owned by a couple of crooks, Peruvian crooks, in fact, and supplied well over 90% of Britain and Ireland's rubber, which was essential in those days for car tyres and electrical cabling and so on. And word began to reach in London about worse atrocities, if it can be believed, going on in the rubber collection in the Amazon by this company. And it was a very, very sensitive and difficult case, because if the company had gone bust, it would have had huge, which the owners were threatening to make it bust, it would have had huge implications both for the supply of rubber and for the British economy. So Casement was sent as part of a commission to investigate that. And what he saw there is absolutely chilling, and he kept a very detailed diary of that trip, and the torture and atrocities of children and babies as on up were truly appalling. And he wrote another brilliant report, which enabled the company law was changed, and all sorts of things happened as a result. And for that, he was made a knight. He was called Sir Roger Casement and became even more famous. But the two expeditions combined gave him such a horror of colonialism in all its forms, and he didn't believe any country should be allowed to have colonies or because of the oppression. And from after that, he resigned from the Foreign Office and gave himself over to liberating Ireland from England.
Yeah, and just, I suppose, and there's a quote there from W.B. Sebald, and I suppose it's more to do with, far more actually, because when you think, irrespective of what people think about colonialism as it was practiced in this country, I think history shows that the extent of exploitation and the cruelty that was done in far further away places was far worse. But it's a great quote here that kind of gives a small insight into him, that it was precisely Casement's homosexuality that sensitised him to the continuing oppression, exploitation, enslavement and destruction across the borders of social class and race and of those who were furthest from the centres of power. And that is a fair old insight into it. As you say, Roland, he began to turn his attention to Ireland. Was it a combination of what he had experienced in terms of colonialism along with his what he regarded as his own roots that did so, or was it something that was always there with him, do you think?
I think his roots had to do with it. I think from what I was saying about his upbringing, I think this sort of, to put a modern psychological spin on it, but I think it's valid, is that I think the disconnection in his upbringing, the fact that his parents died when he was young, and if they were both alcoholic, it would have been a dysfunctional relationship anyway, I think gave him a sort of, as it were, an emotional hole. And part of his great sympathy and giving out of emotion and sympathy was to fill that hole. And I think once he'd carried out his two great reforming reports. The hole remained, and he filled it with Irish nationalism, because that was the thing that was lacking in his upbringing, as it were. Although he was Anglo-Irish, he hadn't got the roots sufficiently, so he was taking the roots into himself. And it became, whenever he set out on a cause, it consumed him. And that's why he hurtled into nationalism as the cause, unsurprisingly, given the period, sort of 1910 on, when the Home Rule cause was consuming a lot of people, he took it up big time.
Yeah, and there's slight echoes with another tragic figure from that period in the country, another Anglo-Irish figure who also did service for Britain, I think it was in the Boer War, Erskine Childers, of course.
Completely, yes. And Erskine Childers, and it was Casement who came up with the gun-running scheme of 1914 that Erskine Childers carried out on the yacht with his wife. So they very much came together in the Irish cause just before the First World War. And yes, distinct similarities, both of them in the Foreign Office, had been in the Foreign Office, both of them would have passed for English. I mean, both had English accents and were educated largely in England, but they threw themselves into that cause, yeah.
Yeah, and also similarities in their demise, in that,
yes,
you'd have to venture that there was a certain hatred against Casement, as he was seen for turning against those he had served. And with Childers, there was a hatred against him by the Free State side on the basis of his activities there, even though Casement, I suppose, in terms of posterity, Childers came out an awful lot better, including that his son eventually became President of Ireland and what have you. But that's neither here nor there.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
So Casement's very involved. And then we get to a point where, was it his idea to go to Germany and what could be achieved there at a time in war, and whether common cause could be made with Irish nationalism?
Yes. So what happened was that Casement went to the United States in the summer, just after he'd set up the gun running on the Asgard, the yacht Asgard. He went to the United States to raise funds in the early summer of 1914, and started out very successfully, only for a matter of days, because then the looming war meant that funds really dried up, because the Irish Americans were conflicted, perhaps, about where they wanted their money to go. Anyway, so funds dried up, and Casement came up with a scheme, which was blessed by the Irish Republican Brotherhood, to go to Germany to raise troops from the Irish prisoners of war that he knew would be taken as soon as the war started. And the Germans, through their diplomats in America, offered to arm these prisoners of war and send arms with them, with a scheme that to us now looks eccentric, to say the least, to actually invade Ireland during the war, in order to ensure that should Germany win the war, Germany would separate Ireland from Great Britain and not just regard it as a continuing colony. And when he went to Germany in October 1914, he was absolutely welcomed at the highest levels of government by the Chancellor and the Foreign Minister, who offered him every support for this scheme.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Yeah, there was some harebrained stuff going on. And even within the GPO during the rising, there were some conversations between Fitzgerald and I think it may have been Cantor Pearce about the possibility of having a German king and what have you. Mm. And at the same time, you had Connolly's citizen army serving neither king nor Kaiser. So there was all sorts of woolly thinking going on at the time and whether England's distress was Ireland's opportunity. Mm. But it didn't go well there one way or the other. And he didn't get on well. And his health began fading a bit as well.
His health began fading. The other thing that was going on, which I think is tragic, is that he was having the only proper romantic relationship of his life.
Yes,
with a Norwegian sailor who he'd met in New York and who became his lover and indeed his servant. He was called Adler Christensen, and he was not a man to be trusted. He was married and had a child in Philadelphia, which he'd never told Casement. And from the moment they arrived in Europe under an assumed name by ship, they arrived in Oslo, in Norway. This man, Adler Christensen, was betraying Casement to the British authorities. So on their first day in Norway, Christensen went to the British legation and told them who he was travelling with and offered to open his post and bring them papers and so on. Meanwhile, he told Casement that he'd been approached by the British. So Casement felt sort of doubly betrayed by the British who he'd worked for, by the English, and yet, in fact, he was being betrayed. So it was this terrible, tormenting twist. And as the nobody who met Adler Christensen liked him, and his friends in Germany were saying, look, you're never going to get your scheme off the ground while you're with that awful man. You've got to get rid of him. And Casement, as a result, got more and more isolated. He wouldn't give up Christensen, got more and more isolated, started sending sort of double bluff stuff to Norway via Christensen, who came back saying the British now want me to kill you, to lure you out to the North Sea and kill you. And that contributed to Casement's depression and paranoia that came about. I mean, he was in Germany nearly 18 months and he spent Christmas 1915 in a sanatorium because he was suffering from such poor mental health, and he always had poor physical health after his time in Africa. He suffered from malaria, and so he was a very sick man by 1916.
And that was really tragic, that relationship, because as you say, under the circumstances whereby he had to the greatest extent hide his sexuality, then he has what he sees as an opportunity for a liaison, and it turns out that this guy is the worst thing that could have happened to him, and had a massive impact on what subsequently befell him.
Absolutely right. And Casement, I don't believe Casement ever quite knew the extent of the betrayal that he'd undergone, but it was horrifying, yeah.
He was probably better off in that respect, you'd wonder.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they decide they're going to come back. He hears about the rising. He wants to get the guns in. He comes on a U-boat, a submarine of the day, and they're to meet up with the Odd in
But he actually realised that without German men, and there weren't that many arms, it's 20,000 rifles where they'd been asking for over 100,000, he believed the rising would fail. And actually, when he came back, he was determined to try to stop it if he could, which of course he couldn't, one man. But he came back Good Friday 1916 on a U-boat with two other Irishmen, including Robert Monteith, who by that time was the chief officer of the Irish Brigade that never happened. And so, yes, they came ashore at Banner Strand before dawn on Good Friday, and that was the first time Casement had been back in Ireland since 1914, but he was only to spend one night there for the rest of his life.
And rendezvous with the odd didn't happen. Yes. That was spotted, and that was us being escorted into the dock when it was scuttled. So
the whole
plan in that respect was kaput, notwithstanding even the idea, even if they had got those guns, for argument's sake, and made to Dublin, I can't imagine it would have made much of a difference. But
quite, yeah.
All of that's another thing.
They were rusty old Russian rifles. I mean, they would have been useless, yeah.
And it was some local people who were involved in spotting him. And one element of the book, the person I thought was great, was there was something really tragic about the way you've set the whole thing out there, Roland, the narrative of him coming ashore and those few hours, and he was hiding out in a fort, and some of the men went into Tralee, they came back looking for him, and ultimately he's rumbled and he is brought up to Dublin and put on a boat over and sent to London, where he's held then later in the Tower of London charged with treason.
Yes, that's right. So he's and he's still in the salt-stained clothes he came ashore in, waded ashore in when he gets to the Tower of London. And he's interrogated a few times by policemen. He doesn't want to give his name, although they know it's Casement. He doesn't want to give his name. He doesn't give his name until late on Easter Day, because he believes he can stop the rising, which of course doesn't happen till the following day. And during that interrogation, a police constable comes in and says, "We've found these trunks in this place in London where Casement lodged occasionally. And in that trunk is his diary from 1903. Which is later to play such a significant part in his last few weeks of life. So, but he doesn't believe, he says there's nothing in the trunks, just a few diaries and things. He doesn't believe the fact he either doesn't remember annotating his sexual encounters in London 13 years earlier, or doesn't believe they could be a problem to him, because it's from that trunk that comes up in his first day of interrogation that the diaries, we first hear about the diaries.
Yes, and as you say, the diaries are to play a major role, and that was largely because, particularly on the base of his past service, he'd been knighted and everything, there was a campaign, both within the UK and further afield, to have his life spared.
Yes, within the UK, there was a huge petition signed by H.G. Wells and Conan Doyle and all the great authors, John Galsworthy, W.B. Yeats wrote letters to the Prime Minister. I believe the Prime Minister realised the danger of executing this man who was an international hero. The British ambassador in Washington was sending telegrams saying, if you execute Casement, there's a chance the Irish-Americans will stop America joining the war, which was essential. The Senate passed a resolution to have his life spared. There was this massive campaign. The Archbishop of Canterbury went to see the Prime Minister and said, you've got to spare this man. He's done more good in his life than any of us could hope to do. And then some pages of the diaries were torn out, and in the National Archives in London, you can see the rest of the diary with these pages missing, 8 pages at the beginning, and photographed. And what these pages had in them, well, they don't exist anymore, but you can see from other bits of his diaries, simple annotation of paid for sexual transactions. So it sort of says, for example, 7 and 6 guardsmen, whatever, behind the Café Royal. And these were photographed, sent round to various newspaper editors. They were sent to the ambassador in Washington at his request, and Archbishop Canterbury got to hear about them, and all the support fell away. I mean, I don't believe that his life would actually have been spared, because it's the middle of the war, the Battle of the Somme's just happening, and it would have been he'd done obvious treachery. So, but even so, the leaking of these diaries was a terrible thing and a terrible blow.
That's interesting. And as you say, Roland, you still think, notwithstanding that, there would have been too much pressure on the basis of the war that was ongoing?
I think so, because I found in the Home Office files that the legal advisor to the Home Office was asked whether homosexuality could be the basis for a plea of insanity, which is what would have spared him if they decided he was insane. And he had to give the legal advice that no, it would not be a basis for plea of insanity. So they would have needed something like that to actually spare him the rope. But anti-German feeling was so high, as I say, the Somme, Battle of the Somme had just started, and for a man who had asked for German help to invade Ireland, I think that would have been possibly a step too far. But there's no question that the leaking of the diaries made the support fall away, and that's the tragedy.
Yeah. No, as you well know, and as you explore in the book, it was long held, grasping at straws, some people might suggest, in this country, that the diaries were forged. This presumably on the basis that we like our clean, cool heroes, and they can't be flawed is the wrong term, but that's the way it would have been perceived at the time.
Quite.
Or anything like that. And so, and this persisted all the way up. And 1999, Bertie Ahern wrote to Tony Blair to see if he could pursue it. But
yes,
ultimately, the diaries were real.
Well, I think Bertie Ahern's letter to Tony Blair is what prompted in 2000 them to be scientifically analysed. And they're unquestionably real. Yes, I think so.
It speaks volumes that so much effort went in to try and disprove it.
Well, it's difficult. I mean, because he is in so many respects a hero that it's very difficult to accept that he had this flaw, really, at the time a flaw. Now, of course, not at all. But it's terrible that the focus was that the diaries were allowed to take away from the many great things he did.
Oh, it is, of course. Again, that's heaps tragedy upon tragedy, really.
And yes,
that's some of the other figures associated with the Rising. There's often been questions about their sexuality, one in particular, and I don't think any of it should ever take away from anything. And again, back to that issue, that being so disposed that you could relate to the most oppressed and the most marginalised, I think definitely fed into that. One thing I'm curious about your opinion on this, Roland. By August, third of August, he was hung. Do you think, and it took a while for the worm to turn, so to speak, and the realisation that what initially appeared to be a great failure in terms of the Rising would turn out to be the foundation for effectively finding what was initially the Free State and ultimately the 26 counties of Ireland. Do you think he had any idea before he died that his efforts and the general effort that went on around the time and the kinship, no doubt, that he felt with the executed leaders, do you think he had any idea that perhaps in the long run something was going to come out of it, or was he totally crushed effectively in terms of all his efforts and without any hope for what he was leaving behind?
What a very good question. I think Casement was above all a romantic who felt he could change the world, and he did change the world, of course, certainly in Africa and South America. I think he must have believed that things would change, and I think he'd accepted a sort of martyrdom by the end of his life, and I think that would have been, he was happy. He seems to me, from the things he said and wrote, quite accepting of his death, that he'd done everything he could. And I believe he must have believed it would change.
And as you're well aware, how he's considered in this country, I'm curious, in terms of your knowledge of say, you know, official historian circles in Britain or in the general thrust of how we all have different histories, naturally, how would Casement be regarded that side of the Irish Sea?
Casement would be regarded as a great idealist, certainly a great reformer. His humanitarian efforts, not in any doubt. I think ultimately what he did in Germany and what he was executed for, his treason, I think this side he's regarded as possibly a bit foolish. I mean, idealism taken too far and to the point of impracticality.
And his body was finally repatriated. I don't have the year again.
1965.
And of course, at the time, the president was Eamon de Valera.
Yes.
Whom I think he knew back in
the
day.
He did know, yes.
Yeah.
And I think de Valera was also appalled by the homosexuality. I think that played a part in the body going back earlier, possibly.
Yeah, which is... Christ, I think that's scandalous of itself.
I know, I agree.
I would have thought at one stage that, you know, there's something poignant about the idea of de Valera, the great survivors, what we're talking 50 years on from the rising.
Yeah.
And here was one of, you know, ostensibly his fellow leaders being repatriated after that. It's poignant in a lot of ways, but as you say, Dave was a complicated man, another kettle of fish altogether. Roland, I have to say, it's a great read. I think anybody who has any interest in history, this man was a massive figure for humanitarianism on a global sense, for what he attempted to do in an Irish sense and everything in that respect. And as I say, really tragic. Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement by Roland Phillips. Roland, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I want to thank our engineer, JJ Vernon. As always, thank you, folks, for listening. We're back with you soon. Take it easy in the meantime.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me? Like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.